And the question is, does this information suggest that climate studies are bogus and global warming is completely made up?
Burned out both?
Hope not.
They found you out.
Connect. No, I'm connected.
Okay, it went off.
It went off. Okay. That's because it. Oh, we didn't see anything here.
There, the green light went on. Lamps on.
Cover off.
Any second.
Yeah, the lens cover's off.
Show us your computer.
Okay. Now it's going to think about showing something. It's there we go.
Oh, we got it.
Okay, where's that?
Very good.
Okay, so on November 20th, 2009, a computer hacker released 200 megabytes of data from the University of East Anglia's Hadley Climate Research Unit. And the data included 1,000 emails and 3,000 documents that were stolen from the server. The question is, do these documents cast doubt on the reliability of the global warming data? Okay, climate change has little to do with the Christian faith, so why should we study it? The thing is, conservatives, probably mostly Christians, insist that the science behind climate warming is probably made up. And if we remember from Y2K, many Christians, including several in this church, made fools of themselves predicting that there was going to be doom and gloom and all the computers were going to fail and we're going to go back to the Stone Age. Okay, obviously that didn't happen. So it's important as Christians that we know what we're talking about, because people will judge our faith on our intelligence or stupidity, as the case may be. So my goal here is to inform you about what happened and what it actually means and what is the actual data look like. So first of all, we're going to go over some basics on how the Earth is warmed by the sun and how all that all really works. So some of the solar energy is reflected by the clouds, and some of it is reflected by ice and snow and such, and the remainder is absorbed by the Earth. Okay, if the amount of solar energy absorbed by the Earth is equal to the amount that's radiated back, then the Earth remains at a constant temperature. Okay, however, if the amount of solar energy impinging on the Earth is greater than the amount that's radiated back, then the Earth gets warmer. Okay, so this is the concern of the global warming people. Okay, likewise, if the amount of energy is less than the amount that's radiated, then the Earth gets colder. And this is how you get ice ages and stuff. Okay, so the greenhouse effect is the main mechanism by which the Earth is actually heated to the temperature that it has right now. And so the Earth acts like a greenhouse, in the energy from the sun penetrates, as in a greenhouse, it penetrates the glass, and the warm and the air and the objects inside the greenhouse get warmer. And then the same glass prevents the heat from radiating back out of the greenhouse. So that's how a greenhouse stays warmer than the surrounding temperature.
Question.
Yes?
About that heat balance. One thing I learned by coming to this class is that the core of the Earth is molten because of nuclear energy, this natural nuclear fission.
Yes.
Does that have a significant contribution to that?
Not really, no. If the sun were to go away, the Earth would just freeze over totally. Okay, so like the greenhouse, the Earth's atmospheric gases affect the ability of the Earth to radiate energy back into space. So we have nitrogen and oxygen make up 99% of the gases of the Earth's atmosphere. And these are non-greenhouse gases. In other words, they're totally transparent to energy release. Water, carbon dioxide, and methane make up the other 1%. And these are the greenhouse gases and the ones that we're concerned with here. Okay, an example of runaway greenhouse effect is what has happened on the planet Venus. Venus's atmosphere consists of 97% carbon dioxide and 3% nitrogen. So it's almost all greenhouse gas. In addition, the surface is covered by dense clouds of water and sulfuric acid. And the combination of these greenhouse gases results in a surface temperature of 860 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a little bit more on the warm side.
And it's worth noting that the whole planet, that's the South Pole, North Pole, equator, everywhere.
Right. So the entire planet is 860 degrees, even on the side that's not facing the sun at the time.
Right.
Okay. So it's actually warmer on Venus than it is on Mercury, which is much closer to the sun. And that's totally because of the greenhouse effect with the excessive carbon dioxide there. Okay, so greenhouse effect does work. You know, it's been proven. So don't let anybody tell you that there's no such thing as a greenhouse effect. Okay, so we're going to look at carbon dioxide just to get a background on what's happened here in the past. And this graph shows the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for the last 650,000 years as determined by Antarctic ice cores. You will notice a large spike at the end of the graph, which can be seen in the inset here, as a dramatic increase in atmospheric carbon over the last 45 years. And obviously this spike is not due to some natural phenomenon. And what it is due to is it's due to fossil fuel burning over the last 150 years. So here we can see carbon emissions from gaseous fuel, natural gas, from solid fuel, coal, and from liquid fuel, petroleum. And when you add these all up, you can see that there's been a dramatic increase in carbon emissions over the last 60 years. Exponential increase.
Question?
Yes?
On the two spikes, they show the spikes, the most recent spike being one of the higher ones. But there were, I think, four other ones that were just as high.
Yes, we're going to get to that.
They aren't due to man-made, so
right.
How do you conclude that?
We're going to get to that. Hold on. Okay. We're going to cover everything, absolutely everything. Okay. So if we look at emissions of carbon, what we find is that isn't completely reflected in terms of the amount in the atmosphere. So in other words, about half of the gas that we're producing is going somewhere. And scientists think that most of it is probably dissolving in the oceans, and some of it is going into trees and plants and stuff. Okay, so things could be much higher than they actually are. Now, in getting to the emails, most of the emails are benign exchanges between scientists, largely of a technical nature. So the emails that you're going to be seeing in this presentation are not typical. They're the outliers, the ones that people get all concerned about. So keep that in mind. You know, these are not like going to be the average of what they actually were talking about.
Emails released by the hacker?
Yes. Some of the emails show a desire to hide or manipulate data that doesn't quite fit in with their hypothesis. And in addition, some of these scientists are not merely impartial data analyzers, but actually are political activists who are engaged in a concerted effort to influence energy policy. Okay, so we're going to look at the players. These are the main players. Phil is Philip Jones, the head of the CRU, Climate Research Unit. Mike is Michael Mann, the guy who created the hockey stick graph, and everybody's going to see that pretty soon, too. Keith is Keith Briffa, another CRU scientist. And Stephen McIntyre is the best known of the global warming critics. And he has the distinction of causing Michael Mann to correct some of his data in a previous publication. And his website is climateaudit.org. And as you can see from the emails that will be coming up, they really hate him a lot. So, are they fixing the data? This is probably the most infamous of all the emails. In it, Phil Jones is bragging, I've just completed Mike's nature trick of adding in the real temps to each of the series for the last 20 years, i.e. from 1981 onwards, and from 1961 for Keith's, to hide the decline. Okay, so the question is, what is Mike's nature trick? And what is the decline that needs to be hidden? Some of the documents included in the release from the CRU break-in consist of programming codes. These are programs that actually do the modeling of producing the figures and everything that they have. And usually in programming codes, the programmers will put in comments that give an idea of what the program is doing so that people can follow along. Of course, not expecting people like us to be following along. But here the comments describe how the maximum latewood density, the MXD, a measure of tree ring density, are corrected. But one shouldn't plot past 1960 because the results will be artificially adjusted to look closer to the real temperatures. Now, this sounds a little fishy. Another program specifies stop in 1960 to avoid the decline that affects tree ring density records. So it's pretty clear that the decline that they were talking about in that other email that needs to be hidden is the decline in tree ring density. Okay. Here's another program from Keith Briffa, and it contains a very artificial correction for the decline. Okay. And it also, the actual program itself has some kind of fudge factor. Okay. Not a good thing. Okay, so let's look at some of these temperature measurements.
What does this decline in tree ring density imply? I'm not quite associated.
We're going to get to that in just a moment. Okay, so past temperatures beyond 120 years ago are approximated with what are called proxies. And common proxies include things like tree ring density, ice cores, pollen records, plant macrofossils, strontium and calcium isotope data, and oxygen isotope data. So that's the kind of stuff that they're using to determine what the temperatures were like in the past. Okay, in 1998 and 1999, Michael Mann published studies detailing his proxy reconstruction of global temperatures for the last 1,000 years. Okay, the graph is basically flat other than the rapid increase of temperatures during the 20th century. The study received wide acclaim, especially after its publication by the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and is now referred to as the hockey stick graph. So I'm sure you're all familiar with that term, and that's where this comes from. Now, the curve in pink represents the actual temperatures that were measured over the last 120 years through the instrument readings. Okay. Now, there are some problems with the tree ring data, which was hinted at by the email that we saw just a while ago. And the problem is that the tree ring data from 1960 on does not match the instrument readings for temperature. So we can see, here's the Jones study from 1998, and the lighter colored curve is the actual one that represents the tree ring density. And you can see there's a big difference between the two readings there. Okay, so that's the instrument reading versus the tree ring reading. Okay, this is from the Briffa study, and again, we have an even bigger difference. Okay, so there's a problem. And this is from Michael Mann's study, and again, his tree ring density sort of flattens out at the end. So if we look at all these graphs together, rather than looking like a hockey stick, now it looks more like a baseball bat, okay? Because there isn't a huge increase at the end, you know. So this could be a problem. And so, what influences tree ring density? Well, the scientists like to think that it's only temperature. However, trees need other things besides just temperature, and one of the things is rainfall. So rainfall, the more water it gets, the more it will grow. And there's also an effect of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide produces this fertilization effect, which will cause plants to grow better. So in all this global warming and increased carbon in the atmosphere, your garden will grow better. You'll be glad to know that. So the question is the hockey stick really correct? Okay, so a number of studies were published after the Mann study. And in 2002, Esper et al. Published a study covering the same period of time, but you can see that there's much higher variations of temperature compared to the Mann study. So all of the ups and downs are about in the same place, the relative amount of magnitude of change is different. Okay. And again, here we have the 1999 Mann study in green, and in yellow we find another study by Moberg et al. Using different proxy measures. And they found a higher difference in temperatures compared to the Mann study. And again, here we're plotting the Esper study and the Mann study and the Moberg study all on the same scale. And you can see that they're not exactly the same. And of course, the Mann study received the most acclaim because it was first. And the other ones have been sort of pushed aside.
Is that the latest one, the Mann study?
Okay, the latest one from Mann. Mann repeated the results using different proxy measures. Okay, and his second experiment published in 2008 has much higher variations than the original one. Okay, but this was largely ignored by the media, of course. Okay, but the big question is whether or not the medieval warm period was as warm or warmer than today. So, you know, we want to see if there are natural variations that have caused the warming, or if it's just totally to the carbon dioxide that we're pumping into the atmosphere. Okay, so Real Climate is a website that's run by some of these climatologists, and they're using it to promote their views, and they have an explanation for Mike's nature trick, and here it is. The trick is just to plot the instrumental records along with the reconstruction so that the context of the recent warming is clear. Clear in terms of what they want you to believe. Scientists often use the term trick to refer to a good way to deal with a problem rather than something that's secret. So there's nothing problematic in this at all. And of course, as a scientist, I can tell you that we don't use tricks. There are no tricks in any of my studies. So I'm not sure what they're talking about, but you know, maybe the average Joe will think that a trick is really some scientific way of doing something, but it's not. Okay, past temperatures. So these are instrumental readings over the last 130 years. And what I want to point out is that even though the trend is going up, there are periods when it's flat. There are actually periods when the temperatures go down somewhat. And again, recently, we're currently in a time in which the temperature readings have been sort of flat. But they're still obviously high. They haven't gone down at this point. But the temperature changes aren't occurring exactly the same during different seasons. For example, this is a graph of the annual temperature changes in Los Angeles for the last 130 years. And you can see it's going up. These are the summer temperature changes, and they're also going up, but not going up quite as quickly as the annual temperatures. As a matter of fact, if you look at the temperatures from the 1880s, they are virtually the same as the temperature in the 2000s. Okay, so there's obviously some variation. Now, if we look at winter temperatures, this is where most of the temperature increase is actually happening. And the winter temperatures have gone up a lot more, and they've risen consistently and dramatically. And the global warming models predict that warming will be greater during the winter than in the summer. And, of course, from a human perspective, higher temperatures in the winter are not necessarily a bad thing because it reduces our freezing and our need for energy and stuff. So not all global warming is going to be bad. Okay, so let's look at the temperature history of the Earth, and we're going to get into some of those questions about what's causing this to happen. Okay, so your question will be answered momentarily.
The fact that you presented Los Angeles temperatures causes me to ask, why are you representing a city, using a city as a proxy for temperature?
Because we live in Los Angeles. That's the only reason why.
There's no scientific implication, though. It doesn't mean anything about the average trend of global.
Well,
as we lay square miles of asphalt every year, it's changed a lot.
We're also going to get to that later on. That will be covered, yes. We're going to hit it all, hopefully. Yes.
Do you know where the LA temperatures came from? Is it a single station or?
There are multiple stations, and I think they're all averaged in. But
the U.S. Historical Climate Network station is up at Fairmont, the other side of Lake Hughes. It's way apart from the metropolitan area. But if they're using other stations, I don't know.
The weather stations.
Yeah. Okay. So let's continue. We can discuss this later. Okay, so for the past 3 million years, the Earth has been experiencing 100,000-year cycles of glaciation followed by 10,000-year interglacial periods. Now, before that, believe it or not, there were no ice caps. Okay, so the Earth's climate has changed dramatically, you know, recently and in the past. So you know, there are some things that are happening, and we're going to go over some of the orbital phenomena that actually cause this to happen.
Where are we in that cycle right now?
Okay, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to everything. Everything is covered here. Okay, so we have three things. We have precession, obliquity, and eccentricity. Okay, we're going to get to all of these. We're going to look at precession first. And precession is how the Earth wobbles in terms of its tilt. And so this is a little animation of the wobble that happens. And right now, the Earth is farthest from the sun during the Northern Hemisphere's summer and nearest during the Northern Hemisphere's winter. However, in another 20,000 years, the Earth will be reversed, with the Earth closest to the sun during the Northern Hemisphere's summer and farthest during the Northern Hemisphere's winter. Okay, so that's one of the parameters. The second one is obliquity, which is the Earth's tilt. And it goes from a minimum of 22.5 degrees to a maximum of 24.5 degrees. Big change, right? Okay. But even that small change can make a big difference. Okay. And the current tilt is right in the middle, 23.5 degrees. You've heard that from Hugh, I'm sure. Okay. The third parameter is eccentricity, which is a measure of the elliptical nature of the Earth's orbit. Okay, so the maximum eccentricity is 0.061. and the minimum eccentricity is 0.005. Now, you should note that these drawings are not to scale. Okay. If we plot the actual maximum eccentricity, it looks like this, which looks almost like a perfect circle. Okay. So even that small change from 0.005 to 0.06 makes a huge difference. So, you know, whenever you hear about all these planets outside of our solar system that have these big elliptical orbits, you know, they're really big. They're just not going to have life on them. Okay, so this is how it all comes together. So we have the precession, which occurs on a 22,000 year cycle. Okay, the next we have obliquity is 41,000 years, and eccentricity is around 100,000 years, which of course coincides with the ice ages. So here's a plot of the temperatures over time that correspond to these orbital cycles. And as you can see, the eccentricity almost perfectly aligns with the periods of ice ages and interglacials. Okay, so those are the major factors that affect the Earth's climate. And the question is, what is happening now and how does that relate to everything in terms of global warming? Okay, so the last ice age began to thaw 15,000 years ago, but it was interrupted by an event called the Younger Dryas event at 12,900 years ago. And this is going to be a complicated graph, but I want you to stay with it because it's going to show you exactly where we came from and probably where we're going. So we have the two curves here represent the temperature and snow accumulation in Greenland over the last 20,000 years. And the last ice age began to thaw about 15,000 years ago, but it was interrupted by a period of cooling. Okay, and this led to the Younger Dryas event. And at 12,900 years ago, there was a period of rapid warming leading into our current interglacial. Okay, and this period has been characterized by about 1,500 year cycles of warming and cooling. Okay, so they've been sort of regular, but not 100% regular. And the last cycle of warming is known as the medieval warm period. Okay, you've probably heard about that. And the last cooling period is known as the Little Ice Age. Okay, so at current time, we are coming out of the Little Ice Age. And so temperatures might continue to rise to a certain degree just because that's where we currently are in our cycle. Yes, Al?
Yeah, this past week I was watching, I think it was Nat Geo channel. They had explained how the Sahara Desert in Africa became so dry. And at one time it was really, really lush and lots of water and all that stuff. And it was due to
precession.
The precession.
Yeah.
And every 20,000 years, they said it comes around.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it, but the other part is deforestation and stuff.
No, that was the main part.
Okay. Are the CRU scientists manipulating data? Okay. In an email to Keith Briffa, Gary Funkhauser said, "I swear I pulled every trick up my sleeve trying to milk something out of that. I don't think it'd be productive to juggle the chronology statistics any more than I already have." Okay, and in response to Rashid Hanatrov, Keith Briffa said, "Is it possible to get the earlier data when you're happy with them? One needs to ask, what kind of data makes us happy? Obviously, it's the data that fits our preconceived hypothesis." In an email to Phil Jones, Tom Wigley said, "Here are some speculations on correcting SSTs to partly explain the 1940s warming blip. So if we could reduce the ocean blip by, say, 0.15 degrees centigrade, then this would be significant for the global mean. Yes, these scientists are talking about manipulating the data to make it fit the hypothesis better. Not a good thing. Okay, many of the scientists are not merely data manipulators, but have the goal of influencing politics. Joseph Almko, in an email to Michael Hume and Rod Swart, said, "Sounds like you guys have been doing good things for the cause." And obviously the cause is not the cause of advancing science, but influencing public opinion. Another email from Graham Houghton to Phil Jones. "Since Sonia retired, I'm a lot more free to push my environmental interests agenda." In complaining about criticisms of the proxy data, Michael Mann says, "All the more pressing the need for more of a community-wide strategizing on our part," which of course they did. Many of the emails contain a liberal amount of paranoia and left-centered politics, here suggesting that right-wing corporate establishment is out to get them, as they did with the Obama health plan and cap-and-trade legislation. So these guys are politically active people. Now, the skeptics have tried to get climatologists to release their original data so it can be reviewed for accuracy. According to the testimony of Stephen McIntyre, Philip Jones said to him, "We have 25 years or more invested in the work. Why should I make data available to you when your aim is to try to find something wrong with it?" And, of course, the goal of science is to find the truth, not to just promote your own agenda. Okay. So in this email, Phil Jones tells his fellow conspirators, "P.S., I'm getting hassled by a couple of people to release the CRU station temperature data. Don't any of you three tell anybody the UK has a Freedom of Information Act." In another email, Phil Jones tells Tom Wigley, "I won't worry about the code. If freedom of information does get used by anyone, there's also IPR to consider as well. Data is covered by all agreements we sign with people, so I'll be hiding behind them." And I don't know what, it's some kind of agreement that they did. Okay. So obviously they were trying to keep things closed. Phil Jones, in an email to Ben Santer, said, "When the FOI request began here, the FOI person said we had to abide by the request. Of course, it's the law, you know. It took a couple half-hour sessions, one at a screen, to convince them otherwise." So they actually convinced their FOI people not to give the data out. Another email from Phil Jones to Michael Mann. "Can you delete any emails you may have had with Keith, RE-AR4? Keith will do likewise. AR4 is the IPCC fourth assessment report published in 2007, of which these scientists were lead authors. And so you know, they wrote the report that, you know, the global warming thing is all happening and everything. So, and they wanted to hide any emails because they were getting all these freedom of information requests and they didn't want the emails to get out in case they had to release them. From Phil Jones again, "A couple things, don't pass on either. You can delete this attachment if you want. Keep this quiet also, but this person who's putting in the FOI request for all emails Keith and Tim have written and received, RE Chapter 6 of AR4. We think we found a way around this."
Are they serious on that, the self-destruct there at the end?
No, I'm sure they're not serious about it. You know, they were joking around. Obviously, it didn't work. The self-destruct button did not work. Okay, so this is from Phil Jones again. "This is for your eyes only. Delete after reading, please." And obviously they didn't. You know. And please delete. and don't even share it with these other guys who we're not real sure about. Okay, this is from Christian Azar to Phil Jones. These reviewers did not request the data, all proxy series, and the code. So acceding to the request for this to do the review is setting a very dangerous precedent. Mike has made all the data series, and this is all anyone should need. Making model code available is something else, especially when it has fudge factors in it. Okay, and they've also written some other things that are not necessarily really nice things. Like they said, I'm sorry you have to go through all this stuff, Phil. Next time I see Pat Michaels at a scientific meeting, I'll be tempted to beat the bleep out of him, but very tempted. So, you know, these are not things that scientists usually say about their fellow scientists. And here's another one where Scott Rutherford is talking about calling in a mafia hit. Obviously a joke, but, you know, I wouldn't joke about that kind of stuff. Okay, skeptics eventually wanted to access scientists' email correspondence regarding the IPCC reports. In a sort of prophetic email, Casper Ammon said, "If I would consider my text to be potentially get wider dissemination, then I probably would have written them in a different style." And obviously they're thinking that way now, for sure.
I just want to say this guy Tim they refer to is not me.
Okay, so here's what the scientists from Real Climate have to say.
Who is Real Climate?
That's the website that they put up to promote their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
All the CRU scientists that we've been talking about. Okay, so they say, who amongst you would really be happy to have all their email made public? And, you know, but as a scientist, I can tell you that, you know, you could read all of my emails and you'd just be bored out of your skull. And we don't talk about mafia hits and hiding data and all this stuff. So, no, we don't have any tricks either. And I'm sure that's true of the vast majority of scientists. Okay, Michael Hume, who's also a climatologist at University of East Anglia, said, it is possible that climate science has become too partisan, too centralized. The tribalism that some of the leaked emails display is something more usually associated with social organization within primitive cultures and is not attractive when we find it inside of science. And that's sort of an understatement. Okay. Does the University of East Anglia's data problem mean that all climate-related data is wrong? There are, in fact, numerous other climate research groups that have produced data that's nearly identical to their data. And this is some of the organizations that are producing their own independent data analysis of these questions. So despite all the data manipulation and attempted deception, their data is probably correct. And now we're going to switch gears for a little while and look at peas. Why do we want to look at peas? Well, Gregor Mendel was the founder of modern genetic inheritance, and he published a paper in 1866 that established the rules of inheritance for genetic traits. Now, the funny thing about his paper is that subsequent analysis revealed that his results were actually too good. There was only a 1 in 100,000 chance that his results could have been so close to theoretical ratios by chance. So, what happened? Okay, a couple things. Either Mendel tweaked the data to make it look closer to the results, you know. He does his study, he tweaks it a little bit, and everybody says, wow, that's amazing. It fits in together exactly like it should, you know. Okay, so that's one possibility. Another possibility is that, you know, when you're doing science, you do lots of different experiments, and maybe Mendel did some experiments that didn't turn out so well, and he never published those. You know, he just let them slide. Now, the really interesting thing about his experiments is that in peas there are only 7 chromosomes. And he picked out 6 traits that all segregated independently on different chromosomes. Now, what are the chances that that would have happened? Almost none. Okay, so he probably did a whole bunch of experiments. The ones where he got linkage and the results were sort of muddied, he just tossed them. Okay. So, you know, in terms of ClimateGate, this is not the first instance in which scientists have tried to make their data look better than what it was. However, this does not justify what the climatologists have done. You know, for those who are not under the authority of the Holy Spirit, you know, the ends justify the means. And so that's mostly what's been happening here. Now, oh goody.
Richard, that didn't that all of Mendel's data was tossed out, did it?
No, Mendel's data was perfect.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
It was perfect. So but he didn't discover linkage. He probably did, but he never published it because he couldn't figure it out. So, you know, he had all these ratios, he did these crosses, and they came out in exact perfect ratios. But if you have two traits that are close to each other, you get linkage. So they'll go with one, and depending on how far they are, you can get some breakage and stuff, and you'll get partial linkage, and it gets really messy. Okay, but he did the perfect crosses, and they came out all perfect.
Yeah, I don't get the point. Does modern genetics agree with Mendel's experiments?
Oh, yes. His experiments were perfect. Mm-hmm. But what are the chances that that's actually what he got? It's almost zero. You know, he picked out stuff that he could understand. And the rest of it he just tossed.
He was doing dihybrid crosses, right? So
yeah.
He didn't have to deal with crossing over where it kind of like muddies up the whole picture. Like,
right. He picked traits that crossed exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't pick out the ones where you had linkage and they were close to each other and you ended up with weird ratios. You know, he got the exact ratios that you would predict if you had these traits segregating independently.
What has that to do with climate change?
Okay. What it has to do was he was fudging his data. He knew he was right, and he wanted to make sure everybody else knew that he was right.
He was a monk, Richard.
He was a monk, I know. So. Okay, so here are some conclusions, and I want to get to global warming myths, because those are probably the best. And a lot of you probably believe some of those myths, and a lot of extremists believe other myths. So we're going to get to that in a second. So the climate scientists have attempted to make their data look better than what it is. Okay, that's pretty clear. They're trying to make it look perfect so that everybody says, okay, we need to do something about CO2 and get rid of it and do all this, spend a lot of money. Okay, and the leading climatologists have attempted to silence critics and prevent publication of critical studies. Okay, this is not necessarily a good thing, but they say that their science is the best, so these other people we're not going to let publish. And a number of climatologists have a political agenda and are attempting to influence energy policy throughout the world. And that's pretty clear from the emails that, you know, they're not just looking at to study, they want to influence energy policy. Ted?
Yes, I understand the NASA fellow also has data that he is sequestered and not allowed to become public. In addition to the Anglia fiasco, nothing was hacked from his site, but he has refused to release his data.
Is that Hansen?
I believe it is.
Okay. I don't know. A lot of Hansen's data is available because I've even downloaded it. Some of this data came from there, you know. So I don't know, but we're gonna get to him a little bit later because he said some things that were sort of off base too. Okay, so global warming myths. Okay, the first myth is that global warming has stopped, and I've heard this quite a lot. Now what this shows, this is the temperature readings over the last 35 years, and you can see towards the end of the graph things are pretty flat. Okay. Now, is there a reason for this? There might be. The curve in orange is solar irradiance. And solar irradiance is the amount of energy that strikes the Earth. And solar irradiance goes through a cycle about every 10 to 11 years. And the cycle actually corresponds with the number of sunspots. So, you know, the sun becomes more active, it produces sunspots, it produces a little more energy, and you get these cycles. Now, what you'll notice is that when the sun's solar radiance goes through the low levels, that what will happen is that the temperatures will level off. Okay, so here you can see a trough, and you can see the temperatures have leveled off during that trough. Again, into the next trough, the temperatures have leveled off. Now, right now, we're at a very deep solar minimum. Okay, this is actually the deepest solar minimum we had for quite a while, and the sun was supposed to come out of it 2 years ago, but it still hasn't. So we're still getting a low amount of energy being produced and still no sunspots. Okay. So that explains why we're not getting this rapid increase at this time, because we are at a solar minimum. So what we are going to expect, though, is that the sun will come out of the solar minimum, and within, you know, 5 to 10 years, we're going to end up into a solar maximum. And at that point, you know, if global warming is real, I will expect, you know, the temperatures to go up pretty dramatically. So we should just sit around, wait, see what happens. And, you know, if they're right, then temperatures will go up again. Okay, so if you plot the average solar output, you can see that solar output is going down even when temperatures are still going up. Okay, so this is a very bad sign in terms of, you know, it's not a solar forcing that is causing this temperature to go up, because the sun is actually going down. Okay, global myth number two. Volcanoes put out more CO2 than fossil fuel burning. Anybody heard of this?
Yeah.
Okay, and here's the amount from volcanoes. Here's the amount from humans. No, it's not close. Not close. No. It's about 3%, actually. And if there's lots of volcanoes, it might get up to 6%, but it's still way low. Okay. Global warming is caused by sunspots. And again, here we have our usual temperature plot. And this is the sunspot data over the same period of time. And we can see the sunspots go up and down and up and down and up and down. And global warming goes up. So probably not caused by sunspots. If you so this is comparing the two graphs. They don't really coincide. Now, if you look over a longer period of time, this is the data from Hadley, UK, where actually we have temperature data going back to 1750. Okay, so I just wanted to show this. You know, we don't have global temperatures because we weren't keeping that. But, you know, some of these weird people in England were doing it. So we have UK here, and it's more or less the same curve that we've seen with the global temperatures. Maybe not as quite as dramatic, but we do have the nice little blip at the end. Okay, and these are sunspot data, which they also collected there for the same period of time. And so if we compare those, there is a slight trend, but it's not obviously not the overwhelming trend. But again, you know, sunspots are correlated with solar output, so you'd expect to have some kind of influence there. Okay, but obviously global warming is not caused by sunspots. another myth is that global warming is caused by gamma cosmic rays. Okay, this is our usual temperature data, and this is the data for gamma cosmic rays. So, again, not a real good correlation by any means. Okay, and when you see these mists, what you'll see is they'll plot a very selective period of time, like, you know, 10 to 15 years, and then it'll look good. But if you plot the whole period, then no, it just doesn't work that way. Okay, CO2 versus temperature. And, you know, the question is, you know, does the CO2 make the temperature go up, or is it just correlated, or how does that work? So this is carbon dioxide levels over the last five glacial periods. And these are the temperature levels during that same time. And so they follow reasonably close, but what you will notice is that when they're tailing off, the CO2 levels are not following exactly close. You're still getting higher CO2 as the temperature's tailed down. Now these.
Why was there such high CO2 in the past?
These are actually related to orbital forcings. Okay, so remember the 100,000 year orbital cycles that we showed earlier? Okay, that's what's causing this. Now the CO2 goes along with it. You know, because when you get higher temperatures, you know, all the carbon that's been frozen up in the north, the ice gets melted, the dead things that were in the soil now have a chance to decay, and the carbon dioxide gets released. So you get this feedback thing where you have a solar forcing and you have a carbon forcing working together. And also, if we look at, this is a plot of sea levels versus carbon dioxide, and you can see they also follow along. Again, there's a little delay at the end of each cycle. Okay, the heat islands. Somebody asked about heat islands. Okay, so we're going to get into that. So a heat island effect occurs when you have a temperature station that's in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden lots of buildings and parking lots are built around it. Okay, and those things attract, you know, the sun's energy, and things tend to warm up. So the question is global warming due to global building of cities near temperature station data? Okay, this is a temperature map of the world, and it shows the temperature differences that have happened in 2009 compared to a period between 1951 and 1980. So we're comparing to the past, what's happening now. You can see in the yellows, the reds, and the oranges, those are the increasing temperatures, and the blues are the decreasing temperatures, and the grays are not measured. Okay, so don't look at the grays. There's nothing there. Okay, and the whites are exactly the same temperature. So you can see that in general the Earth is warming up. But what's interesting is that almost all the warming is happening in very high northern latitudes. Okay, how many cities can you guys name up there? Probably not very many. So guess what? We're not having heat island effects up there. Pretty clear, right? Okay. Okay, but there are heat island effects. And, you know, there'll be some places where the temperatures are probably, you know, kicked up a little bit. So, you know, scientists have been looking at those. They probably play a minor role. Okay. But certainly not a major role in terms of what's being produced. Now, Mount Kilimanjaro is the poster child of global warming because there's a nice glacier on top of the mountain, which looked like this in 1976, and now it's almost gone. It's almost totally gone. It's amazing, you know. In 30 years, the entire glacier has melted. Okay, so global warming, right? Wrong. Okay, what's actually happened here is that if you look at the temperature records around Mount Kilimanjaro, they haven't changed at all. Okay. But what has changed is the precipitation has gone down dramatically. And the reason for that is because the entire area around the mountain has been cleared. Okay, so people have cleared it. There's no transpiration of the water. And so precipitation has gone down. That's why the glacier's gone. Okay, so this is not a global warming thing. But the ice that's melting elsewhere, you know, some of that is. Yes?
Why did they choose to clear out to Mount Kilimanjaro?
People like to cut trees, burn wood, keep warm, make fires, cook. Yeah. Okay. Now, is global warming totally global? Probably not. Okay. So if we plot, this is temperature readings in the northern hemisphere versus temperature readings in the southern hemisphere. So you can see in the northern hemisphere, it's gone up much more dramatically than the southern hemisphere. Now, we can also plot land versus ocean temperatures. Okay, so again, this is the land temperatures on the right there, and the ocean temperatures in the pink are much lower. Okay, and the reason for this is because, you know, the oceans will tend to moderate climate. So the more ocean you have, the more moderate your climate is going to be.
Ocean surface temperature?
Hmm?
Ocean surface temperatures?
These are not ocean temperatures. These are air temperatures.
Oh, air temperature over the ocean.
Yes, over the ocean versus over the land. Okay, so the reason why most of the global warming is occurring in the northern hemisphere is because that's where most of the land is. Okay, so we're going to expect to see less global warming down under. So, you know, if you want to go there, but it's still hot there in the summer. Okay, now, you probably heard it. Sea levels are going to rise 5 to 6 feet in this century. Not right. Totally not right. Okay. The present rate of increase is about 1.8 millimeters per year. Doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, in a century it's come out to about 7 inches, which is somewhat significant. Okay. Some studies are showing that the rate is actually accelerating at about 0.013 plus or minus 0.006 millimeters per year. So if that rate of acceleration continues, we could see about a 12-inch per century rise in sea levels. So scenarios that say, you know, the seas are going to rise a meter and all these places are going to get flooded, that's probably not going to happen. But the state of California commissioned a study by the State Lands Commission, and they claim that sea levels are going to rise 55 inches this century. The lovely state of California. And it's going to inundate all of our ports, and we're going to be in such trouble. Yeah. Of course, they never read the scientific literature, so they just made this stuff up, I guess. I don't know. They are so stupid. Do you wonder why we have a budget crisis? I mean,
scientifically illiterate people to elect these guys, and they're scientifically illiterate.
These people aren't elected, they're appointed by the Democrats. What do you expect? Okay. So I have some data on rising sea levels. Okay, so the green curve is from the Netherlands. The pink curve is from France, and the yellow curve is from Poland, and sea levels are going up. If we plot sea levels versus global temperature change, you can see they're pretty closely related. So that's another indication that the temperature changes that we're seeing probably are real, because they're corresponding to the sea level changes that we're also seeing. Okay, so how much temperature increase are we going to see? Now, you'll find some really alarmist people saying we're going to see 9 degrees centigrade this century. Okay, some of the more conservative studies put the minimum at like 1.5 degrees and a maximum of 4.5 to 6.2. And then a third study says that the minimum is going to be like 2.5 degrees, which is still substantial. Now, we're getting on to Jim Henson here. So this was published from a study in 1988, and he also took this graph and he presented it before the Congress in congressional testimony, showing what he thought was going to happen. So here the graph here is cleaned up a bit so we can actually see what it shows. And what it shows, the white curve are the observed temperatures through 1988. That's the data that he had. Okay. The orange curve is the modeled data that he said would happen if carbon emissions were allowed to go unchecked. Okay. And then we have the blue curve where carbon emissions are moderately curtailed. And then the yellow curve, if at 1988 people said, we're going to stop all the carbon emissions and we're going to stop it right dead in its tracks. Okay, so this is his prediction in 1988. What do you think happened?
Whose prediction was that again?
Jim Henson. Okay, so these are the actual temperature graphs. And as you can see, the curve almost exactly follows the bottom one. Mm-hmm. Okay, even though we did not drastically do anything to carbon emissions. Okay, so obviously he was wrong here. He way overpredicted. Okay, now what I've done is I've taken the current temperature curve and plotted it over a scale where it'll go to the end of the century. And if you draw a line through this, you'll see that it's pointing at about 2.5 degrees. Okay, that's assuming that it goes up at the same rate that it's been going up for the past 30, 40 years. Okay.
You gonna publish it?
No, it's just an extrapolation. Okay, but you know, but actually, you know, I think it would be highly unlikely that it's going to continue to go up like that. It'll probably have some areas where it plateaus off and it goes up. So my guess is it'd probably be closer to 2. But even so, 2 degrees centigrade is not insignificant. You know, that's major temperature increase. Okay. So, we're done. So global warming is happening. Is everybody convinced of that?
Yes.
It is. Okay. Probably most of it is due to human activity. But obviously, you know, in this presentation, you could see that there are definitely some solar forcings and, you know, there could be some orbital forcings in the way distant future. But that's about it. Okay. We're over. Yes.
Is it true that that both warming and cooling are sort of a vicious cycle in that as we get more clouds to hold the temperature in and we lose reflective snow, then it tends to accelerate temperatures even further?
Okay. That's what the climatologists are saying. They're saying that, you know, the carbon dioxide will only do so much. The major greenhouse gas, you know, in the Earth's atmosphere is actually water vapor. And they're saying that the water vapor is going to go up with increasing carbon dioxide. So if that really is true, then it is possible that the temperatures could go up faster than you would predict. But it's also true that, you know, when more water gets into the atmosphere, you have more clouds, you get more reflection. So it's really hard to know at this point, and I don't think they're really totally convincing. Yes. Yeah. Oh.
What is the most climatologists agree with this now? Is this the latest stuff that they do?
Well, I think most of them think that the global warming is really, really serious. Probably more than I would think it is, but you know, it could be serious.
Okay.
But it's probably not going to happen as quickly as they predicted. You know, they predicted in the past and they were wrong. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Do you have a chart that plots the number of cows and therefore methane emissions?
Yeah. Okay. You know, Hugh was on the methane thing.
Yeah.
And so I looked it up. And In reality, methane at this point is not a huge thing. I mean, it's if you include not only the cows belching, but the cows, you know, producing the feed, doing the slaughter. You include everything with cows that you could possibly include, all the energy to keep them up and everything. It's 18%. 18% of the entire greenhouse gas effect.
Does that include the whole world, all the cows?
Yes, all the cows in the whole world.
And all the animals?
No, just the cows.
Okay.
So you know, it's significant, but it's not, you know, if we killed all the cows and had no more cows, it wouldn't fix anything. 18% of 100%. So of man's 100% contribution, 18% is from cows. Raising cows, killing cows, transporting cows, belching cows. Yes.
Mentioning some things. There was a lecture given by John Seinfeld, he's professor of physical chemistry at Caltech 2 years ago. He made a very strong case for correlation of human emissions with global warming. He was very much convinced of that. His lecture had numerous funding sources that indicated that. But one of the things in his slides were that he showed that the human emissions were 8 billion tons a year, a very staggering number. But the interchange between the land and the atmosphere and the carbon cycles was something like 100 billion tons a year. And from the oceans to the atmosphere was over 150 billion tons per year. So that the human emissions were only making a small contribution comparatively, something like between 3% and maybe very optimistically 7%. So what change there was in those emissions could possibly have virtually no effect. The other thing was, he never showed anything but a very simplistic causality. He only accounted for the physical processes of radiation and Earth's albedo and things like that. There's all kinds of other factors about the sources and the cycle of the carbon itself that he didn't explain. But then also, he happened to have in his data the experience of a Viking who came to northern United States, or they might have got as far south as Newfoundland, and found some very feisty natives, so they decided to settle a little further. They found this place to the north they called Greenland, and it was so attractive. They lived there. They had a colony for over 100 years, grew grapes.
Right, that was a medieval warm period.
And meanwhile, in medieval England, they were growing grapes there. That became a wine-producing center. So we had this warming phenomenon in the northern hemisphere, as we observe now, that is taking place, which was far greater than the conditions we observe now. It did not have a catastrophic effect on global climate, but the climate is always changing, as your data points out. But the whole problem here is the distinction between a correlation with carbon dioxide levels and a global warming phenomenon, which undoubtedly has been taking place for the last several hundred years, and causality, what really is the basic cause. And there seems to be a great lack of complete understanding of the full modeling of the Earth's climate. And I've had several conversations with Gregory Marconi from JPL, he's in atmospheric science, and he's very, very concerned about global warming. He's somewhat of an alarmist, but he said that one of the things he pointed out was that all the computer models are inherently defective. They could never be verified. The amount of data required to even verify a model is almost unobtainable. Plus, there's still some very significant mysteries about cloud formation. And the real killer warming gas is not methane, it's not carbon dioxide, it's water vapor. Water vapor has 20 times the effect carbon dioxide because it has a much higher concentration. And cloud formation is a key to the heat balance of the Earth. It has a tremendous effect. And some Danish scientists finally found out about 10 years ago that the cosmic ray intensities cause a variation in cloud formation of 15% from minimum to maximum.
which is very significant. Plus, there was another recent discovery that where they found there was a glaciation of the Earth over, even at low latitudes. It was totally what they call snowball Earth. And all the models, all the atmospheric models and the computer models predict that would be an irrecoverable condition.
Okay, we're going to have to we can talk about this later.
One of the other good studies would be, obviously, is there's lots of studies that there are lots of low technology to cool the Earth. There's no electronic technology to warm the Earth, but there's lots of low technology to cool the Earth. And I would be interested in, obviously, the presentation. We need to close the Earth.
Is this going to be on the paradoxes?
It's on there already.
Okay.
So
the website.
We're done. We're past done.
In the end, it's the sun. In the end, it's the sun.
So let's close. Father in heaven, we thank you for this wonderful day and this glorious weather that we've had, and we thank you for the rain. Father, we thank you for allowing us to look at your creation and understand what it is, and we ask you to help us not to be like the Pharisee who went to the temple and said, you know, I'm not like this tax collector, because we all are, and we need your grace. And even the climatologists, we're not necessarily better than them. So we ask for your grace, and we thank you for your forgiveness. In Jesus' name, amen.